So Parinirvana Day, well, often on Parinirvana Day, the focus is the theme of death, because it's commemorating the death of the Buddha. However, for the Buddha, of course, death was not that important. In fact, it wasn't really significant at all. It was simply another manifestation of impermanence. So impermanence is central to Buddhism, this fact, this truth that all things in the universe, at every level, from galaxies to thoughts, from personal emotions to planets, everything is always changing. In fact, everything is change. Everything is changing all the time. Change is constant. So in this talk, I'm not going to focus on death. This is a talk about the Dharma. It's a talk about Buddhism. And any talk about Buddhism will usually include reflection on impermanence. I think you can treat this as a kind of reflection. Some of you who've been here all day have been reflecting. And one of the points I want to make throughout the talk, I'll recur to, is the importance of reflecting. And particularly the importance of reflecting using your imagination. Reflecting imaginatively, as it were. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the life of the Buddha, but the life of the Buddha before he was the Buddha. Because actually, that's possibly more relevant to us. Siddhartha, before he was the Buddha, was in a way like us, struggling to follow the path, as it were. So I'm going to talk about the life of Siddhartha and draw some points out of that life, using that life as a kind of symbol, a kind of representation of the life of any human being. So Buddhism consists of the path and the teachings which enable all human consciousness to unfold and evolve into the awakened state, that's awakened to the true nature of reality. And in this talk, as I said, I'm going to look at that path as it's illustrated by the life of Siddhartha. So the story of the life of Siddhartha is a universal story. And the significant episodes in that life are, well, they indicate truths that are relevant to the spiritual life of any practitioner. So I'm going to look at some of these episodes in the life of Siddhartha from the four sites, right up to the, as it were, archetypal images associated with the experience of enlightenment. And I want to draw out the universal significance of these episodes. And perhaps a few points that could be of specific significance to us today. So to begin with the four sites, I think this episode prefigures the later story, the legendary story, as it were, of the appearance of Mara, the earth goddess, Brahma Sahampati, and Muchalinda at the time of the awakening. So I'm going to look at the parallels later on in the talk. So the story of the four sites tells us that Siddhartha had led a very sheltered life, protected by his father from all suffering. But as a restless young man, he found a way to get out and have some wider experience. And what he experienced was seeing a sick person, an old person, and a corpse for the first time in his life. And also seeing a wandering holy man. And these sights, we're told, had a very profound effect upon him, and led him to giving up his life of luxury and going forth into the world in search of truth and in search of a solution to the problem of human suffering. Now, you could take this story literally. You could take it literally he had never encountered sickness, old age, and death before. Or you could understand it as meaning that he saw these things as if for the first time. In other words, he saw the significance of sickness, aging, and death. He saw that it was what happened to everyone, and what would happen to him. He saw it clearly. He saw it clearly with the force of a shock. He saw it in such a way that he couldn't deny it and he couldn't ignore it. He couldn't just carry on living as if everything was the same as before. Because now death was a reality for him. Illness and old age were realities, and they had to be faced up to. So he couldn't go back to a superficial life in the face of these existential facts, which had shocked him into waking up to what you might call the naked insecurity of life. So this was a process of insight for Siddhartha, and it's a process that happens for many people. Perhaps it's happened for some of us here. For some people, this sort of awakening has a profound life-changing effect, and they set out on a journey of spiritual searching and spiritual discovery, just as Siddhartha did. And for others, the experience gradually fades and old habits take over again, so that they manage to ignore their deeper experience. And of course, some people deliberately bury their insight, that insight into life's insecurity. They deliberately bury it under hedonism or addiction or whatever. And some people embark on a spiritual quest, but get lost along the way, or begin to use their spiritual practice as a way of avoiding the raw truths of sickness, old age, and death, rather than as a way of facing and transcending them. But many of us, hopefully all of us here, are inspired by the image of the wandering holy man, the image of someone who gives up everything for the sake of truth, someone whose life is a wholehearted quest for truth. Now, seeing these four sights is not an easy matter. I don't believe it is usually a one-off event. Seeing these four sights is a process of deepening insight, a process of dawning clarity, a process of emotional, intellectual, and spiritual adjustment to the fact that life is change. So sickness, old age, and death are inevitable because change is the nature of life. The more deeply we see and understand this, the more acceptable it becomes, and therefore the less we suffer by trying to resist change. So this process of seeing the four sights, seeing them deeply, being affected by them, understanding and being moved by the significance of them, this process can go on throughout our life. And it's worth our reflecting on these four sights again and again. So this is the first time I'm mentioning this theme of reflection. We can reflect by asking ourselves questions. We can ask ourselves questions like, what is my attitude to illness? Do I see any deeper significance in it? Is my attitude to illness different when it affects me and when it affects others? Why is it different? And similarly with old age and death, what are my attitudes to old age and death? Am I aware of old age and death around me? Am I aware of myself as someone who is subject to old age and death? Sometimes it's easier to be aware of other people as being subject to old age and death rather than ourselves. And what does the wandering holy man mean to me? Is there an equivalent? Is there an equivalent of the wandering holy man in my life? So something that reminds me of the deeper significance of life, or of the spiritual dimension of life, something that reminds you of that. Is that there in your life? How often am I aware of that dimension, of the wandering holy man? Am I moved to action by the image of the wandering holy man, by the reflection of on the deeper significance of life, on the spiritual dimension of life. And perhaps for some of us, the question will be, have I really seen the four sights? And if I have, am I still aware of them? Have I really seen sickness, old age and death and the wandering holy man? And if so, am I still aware of them? I know for myself, because I've been healthy most of my life, I think I'm not that aware of sickness sometimes. It comes as a shock to me if I get sick, because it's not something I normally experience or think about or reflect on. As I get a bit older, I'm having to take it on board more. I know Sangharakshita some years ago, when he was experiencing the effects of old age affecting his eyesight, he was saying that he had reflected deeply on death and was very aware of death as it affected him, but he hadn't reflected deeply enough on old age and the effects of old age. So these things are not easy. It's not easy to be aware of sickness, old age and death. And as I say, it's a process that can go on over years. Anyway, Siddhartha did see the four sights, and he saw them very deeply. He saw the significance of sickness, old age and death, and the wandering holy man. And it shook him. It shook him to the core of his being. As I said, he couldn't be the same again. He had to change his life. So he left home and he set out in quest of the truth, in quest of the answer to the problem of human suffering. And this episode in his life is known as the going forth. And of course, going forth doesn't just apply to Siddhartha, to the Buddha. It can apply to any one of us, and probably does apply to us in different ways. Some of us may be more, as it were, in the traditional mold of actually leaving home and doing something like a journey. Sangharakshita, again, in his memoirs, talks about going forth, literally, you know, giving up everything, actually getting rid of his papers and passport and everything, and going forth in quest of truth. Myself, when I was 22, long before I was a Buddhist, I gave up my career, gave up everything to go in search of meaning, as it were. And that was as a result, actually, of seeing an older person in the workplace where I was retiring, and seeing how empty their life was after they'd spent 50 years and in that workplace and in that job. It just, as it were, shook me, and I gave up everything. I did find Buddhism 6 years later. So the going forth represents a reorientation of one's whole life. It involves actively moving away from the mundane, self-interested values of the world around us and moving towards values that are compassionate and based in a deeper awareness of the nature of life. Sometimes it's quite difficult to see what the values of the world are, because we're so much in the world. It's like we're fish swimming in water. We can't see the water. We're so much influenced by what we read, what we hear, what's in the newspapers, what's on the internet, what's on TV, and so on. And if we're not sufficiently aware, we may not even notice that certain values are being promulgated all the time by the media, by politicians, and so on. We may not even notice that those values are the values of the world. Some of the more obvious values today are, for instance, that choice is a good thing, that economic growth is a good thing, that nation states have a real existence, that quality of life can be measured by the ability to buy things. And so on, lots of things like that. And some of these values will be so much part, as I say, of the air that we breathe, that we will apply them to our spiritual practice without even notice. So, for instance, I've noticed that the notion of choice has become more and more prevalent over, say, about the last 10 years. I am one of those people who listens to Radio 4, and often you'll hear a politician telling you that what people want is choice. They never tell you quite how they know this, but they do know it, and what people want is choice, and they promise to give us choice. And everywhere you go, on the internet, on TV, in the shopping centres, you're inundated with offers of choice. Yeah, and of course we often believe it. We can kind of smile at it when we bring awareness to it, but often we actually believe it. We believe we are being offered genuine choices, and that having these choices gives us greater freedom. So we become enthralled to the idea that choice means freedom, and we start to look for choice in our spiritual life. A choice of practices, a choice of lifestyles, a choice of teachings, a choice of teachers, and so on. And of course, the choice is there. There's a whole spiritual supermarket of choices, yeah? A whole shopping mall of choices, even within Buddhism. And then, of course, outside of Buddhism, more and more. There's a whole smorgasbord of choices, yeah? Lots of tasty morsels. So this one value of the world we live in could potentially cause us a great deal of confusion. And it could lead us astray on all sorts of interesting sidetracks, away from discovering depth of experience, especially if we haven't quite seen the four sights yet. So I'm not saying it's wrong to investigate other practices and so on. I'm just pointing out, as it were, that we should go for depth in what we do. So going forth, as I said, is a reorientation of our life towards the spiritual values of awareness and compassion. A reorientation toward the value of awakening more and more to reality. And we need to, as it were, examine other values in the light of this. Does the multiplication of choices lead to greater awareness and compassion? Does nationalism lead to greater awareness and compassion? Does consumerism lead to greater awareness and compassion? So again, reflecting, asking ourselves questions. What values do we have? What values are promoting greater awareness and compassion in our lives? And what values are hindering our awakening to reality? What values are obscuring our vision of the four sights? So I'm talking about these questions and asking ourselves questions as a way of reflecting. I think it's not such a good idea to expect immediate answers from yourself or anybody else. The important thing is the question, not the answer. The best answers come from the depth of your own experience. But if you have, as it were, an attitude of questioning, an attitude of reflecting, then in your ordinary life, as experience happens, as it were, you will be reflecting, because you will be bringing that attitude to whatever happens. You will be seeing the significance. So for Siddhartha, going forth meant a complete change in his life, internally and externally. For us, each of us, it may mean that, or it might mean something else. But whatever it means, I think going forth is best seen as an ongoing process rather than a one-off event. And as I'll point out later on, it was actually an ongoing process for Siddhartha as well. There wasn't just one going forth. So the event going forth in the life of Siddhartha symbolizes a process. It symbolizes a process that carries on until awakening or enlightenment dawns. And it's the process of letting go of everything. Everything that holds us back from seeing clearly the truth of constant change. Everything that holds us back from living our lives by the truth of constant change. And that truth, the truth that everything is changing all the time, constant change, that applies to our bodies, our thoughts, our emotions. It applies to other people. It applies to everything in this world. It applies to the whole universe. The truth of constant change transcends death, because death is only a moment in the vast interplay of energies we call life. So we go forth from limitations. We go forth from limiting views, from limiting values, towards an open road. Walt Whitman, the American poet, often used that image of the open road for going forth. An open dimension where we can live in harmony with the reality of constant change. In the Pali Canon, in the Sutta Nipata, this is how the Buddha's or Siddhartha's going forth is described, in his own words, as it were. Now I will tell the going forth, how he, the mighty seer, went forth, how he was questioned and described the reason for his going forth. The crowded life lived in a house exhales an atmosphere of dust, but life gone forth is open wide. He saw this and he chose the going forth. So let's hope that given all the choices we have, that we too choose the going forth again and again. So the next episode in the life of Siddhartha that I'd like to look at briefly is his attainment of dhyana, of higher states of consciousness in meditation practice. Siddhartha became the disciple of Alara Kalama, who was one of the great teachers, spiritual teachers of the time. That was his first teacher, and then later he became the disciple of another teacher called Udaka Ramaputta. And under these teachers, he became very adept at entering dhyanic states of consciousness, right up to the formless, the highest formless dhyanas. So he was very adept at meditating. He was such a good disciple that Alara Kalama asked him to become co-founder of his community of followers. And Udaka Ramaputta asked him to take over complete leadership of his community. However, Siddhartha was not satisfied and was well aware that he was still within the realms of egotism and had not solved the problem of suffering. So he actually left these teachers and went forth yet again. So this process of going forth, as I said, carries on. This time he went forth to a life of great austerity. So I think many of us would love to be able to get into dhyanic states at will. Indeed, many of us probably feel that not being able to attain to the dhyanas means that we can't meditate. We may even become despondent about meditation and perhaps give up because we can't get into dhyanic states. But dhyana is not the aim of spiritual practice. At best, it's a support to spiritual practice. And sometimes it can be simply a pleasant side effect. In some Tibetan traditions, the student is actually warned against dhyana and told to come out of it as quickly as possible. It's regarded as a distraction. I don't think I'd like to go that far, but that's one tradition. In the Pali Canon again, in the Brahmajala Sutta, the Buddha outlines 62 wrong views to be avoided if one is to make spiritual progress. And the interesting thing about these wrong views is that most of them arise out of some kind of higher experience, and quite a few arise from misinterpretation of higher dhyanic states, higher dhyanic experience. Kamala Shila, another order member, he put it in a talk on the subject. He said, it seems that if one practices within a framework of self-view, within a framework of ego identity, as it were, then every attainment in meditation will simply confirm that view. So that's the, as it were, danger of dhyanic experience. It could lead us into a cul-de-sac of wrong views, which block further spiritual progress. Anyway, Siddhartha saw this and went forth from dhyana as an end in itself. And perhaps we need to reflect on the significance of this. If we're regularly in dhyana, we may need to let go of it, go forth into deeper insight. And if we're regularly yearning to experience dhyana, perhaps we need to go forth from that yearning and start to see our meditation practice as being concerned with truth-seeking rather than pleasure-seeking or peak experiences. The pleasure will arise of its own accord. So then Siddhartha undertakes severe austerities in line with practices that were current at that time. It was felt one of the strains of spiritual practice then was that it was felt that the demands of the body for food, sex, warmth and so on were a major hindrance to spiritual insight, and therefore the body had to be subdued. Anyway, it's said that he took this to an extreme, but in the end he realized that it was not helping, and he went forth from this life of austerities as well. That's his third, as it were, major going forth. Now, I don't think there are many among us who undertake austerities. Actually, I'm not aware of anybody, but just leave that little gap in case there's somebody. But still, there are some lessons to be learned here. So Siddhartha moved from blissful practices to painful practices, hoping that what he couldn't gain through bliss, he would gain through pain. And it is true for many people in the FWBO that there can be an overemphasis on pain. We can give quite a lot of attention to painful emotional experiences, and we can perhaps value them more than we need to, even considering them to be somehow more authentic or real than pleasurable experience. There's an American psychotherapist and mystic, Suzanne Segal, and she talks about this from her experience as a spiritual teacher, but also as a therapist. She writes in her book, Collision with the Infinite, she writes, the negative is usually taken to be the truth. After all, the negative is so compelling and seems so deep. The positive is regarded as superficial and temporary. But the negative. When it arises, we believe we're really in the presence of truth. Connecting with others in our Western therapeutic culture is often based on a sharing of problems. When someone refuses to reveal what is most difficult in their lives, they're said to be withholding or cut off or untrustworthy. When their problems are known, however, they are thought to be revealing the truth about themselves. This overvaluing of the negative is rampant in our culture. Just about every person who sits across from me in my office and speaks to me about their lives believes that what is negative about them is most true. They are convinced that they carry something rotten at their core, that they are bad deep down, and that they will always return to the negative, which is the real bottom line. So, for some of us at least, there may be a sense in which we could helpfully go forth from an overemphasis on painful aspects of experience. We could, for instance, deliberately affirm what is positive in our lives. Some people have a practice of just thinking at the end of the day, what did I enjoy today? What was most enjoyable? Think of 5 things, 10 things that I enjoyed today. And it can give you quite a different perspective on life if you deliberately do that. You deliberately think at the end of the day, 10 things I enjoyed today. Really kind of very small things would do. You know, I enjoyed the light through the trees or the clouds in the sky or whatever it was I enjoyed. What you find if you do something like that is you start to notice those things. You start to notice enjoyable things. You start to notice enjoyable experiences. You start to actually have more enjoyment in your life. Mm-hmm. So it's quite good to do some sort of practice like that that affirms what's positive and what's enjoyable in your day-to-day life. So sometimes it's said that Siddhartha was making an unbalanced effort in practicing all these austerities, and he needed to find a middle way, a more balanced effort. This is not borne out by the text, though, which represented him as making a very strong, even forceful effort when he sat beneath the Bodhi tree. What was wrong about his effort in austerity, as it were, was that the effort was in the wrong direction. It was leading nowhere. That's what was wrong about the effort. So what we have to consider about our spiritual efforts is not so much a matter of quantity, but rather a matter of quality. We don't need to worry too much that our efforts might be too strong. What we really need to pay attention to is whether our efforts are effective, spiritually speaking, whether they're leading in the direction of truth, the direction of more awareness, more compassion, more metta. So Siddhartha went forth, and in the process of going forth this time from austerities, he also lost his reputation and was heavily criticized by his former companions. So going forth, it seems, can bring unpopularity. Your friends and your family might think you're being foolish or a failure if you turn your back on material values, on materialism. Anyway, he took some nourishment and he sat down beneath a peepal tree, thereafter known as the Bodhi tree. And this tree itself is quite symbolic. It prefigures the image of Muchalinda, which I'll talk about later. The tree represents a unity of the heights and the depths. Its roots go deep down into the soil, and its branches soar heavenwards. So it's generating energy in the hidden depths and manifesting beauty and protectiveness in the world. And this uniting of opposites, depths and heights, inner and outer, symbolizes the enlightened state, a state of completeness, uniting wisdom and compassion, uniting energy or activity and stillness. And this is something worth reflecting on. Do we have a sense of heights and depths in our lives? Or what do we mean by heights and by depths? In what way are our heights and depths not united? In what way are they united? How could we bring about more unity of our heights and depths? Or to put it another way, do our ideals, our aspirations, our dreams have a strong connection with our ongoing awareness of ourselves, physically, emotionally, and mentally? So are the branches connected to the roots by awareness and metta? So Siddhartha was sheltered by the tree, or put symbolically, his aspiration and faith gave him protection. And he needed protection because he was now assailed by Mara. And Mara, of course, is the personification of resistance to spiritual awakening. Firstly, he was attacked by Mara's army. Then he was tempted by Mara's daughters. And then Mara tries to undermine his confidence. So we have, these are very dynamic images for hatred, craving, and ignorance. So Mara's army attacks with arrows and spears. But all these missiles that are hurled at Siddhartha, they all turn into flower blossoms, and they settle gently at his feet. So this attack of Mara's army represents a massive internal conflict. Yeah, Siddhartha's unshakable determination is coming up against all the forces of his psyche that resist the implications of spiritual death. And this is an inevitable part of any spiritual endeavor. We're never 100% behind our spiritual aspirations, and so we experience conflict. And you could say that dealing with that conflict is the raw material of our spiritual practice. That's what we're working with, the conflict between our spiritual aspirations and our actual desires and experience. So we can take this raw material of inner conflict and do something creative with it. If we don't deal with our inner conflict, it will begin to manifest externally. We'll end up blaming other people for our lack of spiritual progress and our limitations, or blaming situations. It can seem more reasonable and more comfortable to blame others for our hindrances and settle down into a habit of rumbling resentment. So on one level, inner conflict is a manifestation of an unintegrated psyche, and the disparate parts have to come into some sort of relationship. Just as the Buddha's awareness and faith comes into relationship with Mara's armies. And a conflict, in that case, resolves into flower blossoms, symbols of beauty and growth. On another level, inner conflict is a manifestation of the ego's resistance to reality. It's an existential thing, this inner conflict. I suppose it's worth saying here that experiencing inner conflict doesn't mean that we're bad or unspiritual or incapable of spiritual practice. It is what happens if you try to lead a spiritual life. You will experience spiritual conflict. If you haven't done so already, you will. Yeah. So either way, it's more creative to recognize our inner conflict for what it is and take awareness into it. So we have to become acutely aware of how we resist spiritual insight and how we cause ourselves suffering. And if we manage to do this thoroughly, then our resistances will subside. So for instance, and this is just for instance, I'm not talking about anything in particular here. We may have an ideal, for instance, of spiritual community, an ideal of harmony and cooperation and goodwill. I'm sure we all have that. It's very attractive. We value friendship. We value collective activities. But then we may find ourselves actually feeling very lonely or isolated. And we think our ideal is not working. And this leads to a conflict within us, a conflict between our personal experience and our ideal. So this could lead us to blame the other people around us. It's because they are selfish, or because they're unfriendly, or because they're English, or whatever. I've heard that, yes. That's why your ideal of a harmonious spiritual community is not happening. That's why you feel lonely. Or you might blame the circumstances. It's because community life, if you're living in a residential community, maybe you start to feel community life is unnatural. Or it's because the Buddhist center is not being run properly. Something like that. So we look outside ourselves for causes, and we find lots of imperfections in the people and in the world around us, which seem to be very plausible reasons for our dissatisfaction. That's what life is like. Yes, as we just look around and we see lots of imperfections. They're there all the time. But we could take a different approach, yeah? We could assume that our conflict, our inner conflict, is a manifestation of egotism in some form or other. And when I say egotism, again, I'm not saying something that's bad, if you see what I mean. It's just a description of the way things are for most of us, most of the time, for many of us, all our lives, yeah? We operate from an egotistic standpoint, yeah? So we could just assume that this is a manifestation of egotism in some form or other, and we could investigate it from that standpoint. We could ask ourselves, in what way am I being selfish? How is my, in this case, the example I'm using, how is my loneliness and isolation a manifestation of selfishness? This is probably a very strange question for us sometimes. We might discover some things to make us, as it were, sit up and take action. We might realize that the antidote to loneliness lies in our own hands. We need to think of others. We need to go out to them, befriend them. So it's a kind of counterintuitive response. Loneliness doesn't mean I need friends, it means I need to befriend others. In a way, what we discover when we look deeply into our dissatisfaction is that we're both, in a way, the victim and the perpetrator. Yeah, we're experiencing suffering and we're actually causing suffering. We're causing our own suffering often. And if we see that clearly enough, if we see clearly enough that we are causing our own suffering, then the spears and arrows, as it were, of the inner conflict will turn into flower blossoms. So another aspect of Mara's army is that it represents fear, our worst nightmares, all the fears that hold us back from living more fully. So fear is one of the most tangible experiences of ego that we can have. Where there is fear, there is ego. So if you don't think you're very egotistic or whatever, just watch where you experience fear and you find that's where your ego is, yeah? Again, not a bad thing, it's just how it is, yeah? So where there's fear, there's self-centeredness. The tantric yogis go into the cremation grounds at night to encounter fear. So they go into the cremation ground at night to encounter ego in a very potent form. And by facing fear, they break through it to a new level of freedom, which is symbolized by the dakini. So most of us have no need to find a cremation ground. We experience fears, large and small, all the time. Sometimes it's just a fear of being with other people, or the fear of being alone. So we can try to notice our fears and make use of them in our spiritual practice by taking little risks here and there. If we do that, we gain a little more freedom every time and develop the habit of freedom and confidence. On a personal note here, at the time when I was ordained, 1988, one of my greatest fears was the fear of speaking in public. Yeah, and at the time, I assumed that was something that every order member had to do. Every order member had to speak in public, give talks, and I dreaded that. So I was on the verge of holding back from ordination to avoid ever having to speak in public. Anyway, it was only by doing it that I gradually discovered it wasn't so bad as I'd feared. After Mara's army, we have Mara's daughters. So Siddhartha was a heterosexual man, so Mara's daughters represent craving for sense pleasures. Siddhartha is not having an easy time here. It's one distraction after another, yeah? So earlier on, we were told that he could get into dhyana at will, and now he's enmeshed in conflict and distraction. So from one point of view, he's having a really bad meditation. Yeah? Anger, ill will, fear, craving, it's all there. So I'm sure some of you are familiar with this kind of meditation, or at least you've heard about it. Yeah? But Siddhartha knows what he's doing. He's deliberately facing all the resistance, all the egotistic forces of his own mind, and transforming them into something positive. Mara's daughters, the energy of craving, are transformed into inspiration, the energy of faith, or Shraddha, represented by the earth goddess. Mara's armies, the energies of inner conflict, are transformed into compassion, represented by Brahma Sahampati. And Mara himself, the energy of ignorance, is transformed into the great wisdom represented by Vichalinda. In the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Mahayana text, Mara tries to make a gift of his daughters to a monk who refuses to accept them, because it would be very un-monk-like to accept them. Yeah. But Vimalakirti, who's the hero of that story, does accept them and turns them into teachers of the Dharma. So Mara's daughters are the energy of desire, which can move from being desire for sense pleasure to being desire for the Dharma, from Kamachanda to Dharmachanda. In the symbolism associated with Siddhartha's struggle, the earth goddess Vasundhara could be seen as his muse, his inspiration, his Dhammachanda. She's the transformation of the energies represented by Mara's daughters. The earth goddess is a witness to Siddhartha's practice over lifetimes. She's an appeal to experience. So in the context of transforming energies, the energies of craving, this means that if we bring awareness to our actual experience over and over again, if we look closely and honestly at our actual experience, we will see that our dissatisfaction has never been fully satisfied by succumbing to our sense cravings. In fact, our craving for sense pleasure is itself dissatisfaction. It is dukkha, it is suffering. Our experience is telling us this truth all the time. And if we listen often enough, eventually we will hear. The earth goddess, as I said, is an appeal to experience in the face of doubt and lack of confidence. So Mara suggests to Siddhartha that he is wasting his time. He could be having a good life. He could have plenty of money, he could have property, he could have power, whatever he wanted. It's all his for the taking. Who does he think he is anyway, trying to solve the problem of human suffering? So he's assailed by doubts, doubting whether what he's doing makes sense and doubting whether he is capable of attaining to wisdom. I think, again, anyone who's on the spiritual path, at some point or other, you're going to experience doubt. Yeah, you're going to experience those kind of doubts. You're going to doubt whether what you're doing makes sense and whether you're capable of it. I certainly have experienced that. And the earth goddess emerges and she reassures him that she has witnessed all his efforts and he is indeed capable and worthy of gaining enlightenment. The earth goddess has always been there. She represents something timeless, eternal, and she can attest that the pursuit of truth is a worthy and worthwhile endeavor for human consciousness. We could even say that the earth goddess asserts that it's natural for human consciousness to want to evolve towards the truth. She's hinting at something that's made more explicit later on in the White Lotus Sutra, that the Dharma is eternal or timeless. Reality is always reality, has always been reality, and will always be reality. So this is the answer to Mara's attempt to sow the seeds of doubt. So when we experience doubt, we may find it helpful to reflect on what spiritual experience we have had and what spiritual progress we have made. We may also find it helpful to reflect on the millions of people down the generations who've been inspired and uplifted by the Dharma, a kind of concrete testimony to the power and efficiency of the Dharma. So when we're beset by doubts, what we need to is to appeal to experience and inspiration. So we can appeal to our own experience and inspiration or the experiences and inspiration of others. And if we do that, then we'll have the earth goddess on our side. In fact, often if we're experiencing doubt, we do need the help of others in some way. So the next episode represents a big turning point, a kind of internal going forth. Brahma Sahampati appears. The story says that the Buddha was inclined to keep his realization to himself because nobody would be able to understand it, and Brahma Sahampati appeared before him, telling him that there were some who would understand and pleading with him to teach what he had discovered. So Brahma Sahampati represents great compassion arising in the mind of Siddhartha. Previously, he's been concerned with an internal struggle to overcome fear, hatred, craving, and doubt. But now he's turning outwards, he's becoming concerned with the fear, craving, hatred and doubt of others. So having seen through the causes of suffering in himself, he now wants to help others to the same realization. And this process, again, is sometimes mirrored in our own lives. Often we take up the spiritual life for a mixture of selfish and idealistic reasons. And as we practice, we experience the conflict between our recalcitrant egotism and our altruistic aspirations. In a way, we necessarily become concerned with ourselves, with the workings of our own mind, the trajectory of our own habits, and so on. However, in time, we should experience a quietening of this inner turmoil and a growing concern for the spiritual welfare of others, and a willingness to help others through the mess of their inner conflicts. So as with all the other episodes in the life of Siddhartha that I've been talking about, this episode also represents a process, a gradual process, the process of growing generosity and compassion. We all have our own version, as it were, of Brahma Sahampati, a voice, as it were, urging us to acts of generosity and kindness. And as we progress spiritually, we will find ourselves listening to that voice more and more. And the more we hear that voice and pay attention to it, the more we can be sure that we are developing or progressing spiritually. So the next episode is the appearance of the serpent king, Muchalinda. And he appears in order to protect Siddhartha from the rain, it says. He wraps his coils, the serpent wraps his coils around Siddhartha. And he spreads his hood over him. And this image, again, reminds me at least of the Bodhi tree, shading Siddhartha from the sun. And when the rain stops, the serpent king transforms into a young man and salutes the Buddha. This young man, about 16 years old, represents the prime of beauty and purity and is later seen in the form of the archetypal bodhisattvas, the spiritual heroes. So the serpent king, the king of the Nagas, comes from the depths. It comes from the depths of the ocean. Nagas are associated with wisdom, with depth of understanding. And the great Buddhist sage Nagarjuna is said to have traveled to the bottom of the ocean where the Naga kings transmitted to him the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. So the Naga king stands for wisdom, and the youth is the spiritual hero, the bodhisattva, acting compassionately in the world. So again, the serpent king and the youth represent a unity of heights and depths, a unity of opposites in a way, as in the image of the Bodhi tree, but now perhaps at a higher level. Unity of wisdom and compassion, unity of stillness and activity. And the serpent is also an image of tremendous energy, the gathered energies of the enlightened consciousness. So our spiritual life is fed and nourished by images and symbols, and our imagination is the crucible in which our lives are transformed into what you might call energy streams of wisdom and compassion. We need images and symbols. We need all of the images and symbols of the life of Siddhartha. And there are some I haven't touched on. We need to allow our imagination time to engage with the whole rich panoply of images that Buddhism offers. And it doesn't do to reject some images as not suitable. All the images are interconnected, interwoven. They're a huge pattern of psychic growth. If we reject some images, we may be disrupting the pattern and making our, as it were, making our psychic life more difficult. I mention this because in recent years some people have wanted to reject the image of the young hero. But here with Muchalinda you can see that the young hero is integral to a complete image. It's part of a union of opposites. Anyway, usually I think when we want to reject images or symbols, it's because we're taking them too literally. We're giving them too literal a meaning. So we should reject literalism in the realm of symbols, not the symbols themselves. So we began with the four sights, sickness, which mirrors Mara, the sickness of the mind, humanity's illness. Then old age, which mirrors the appeal to experience and ageless wisdom of the earth goddess. And then death, which mirrors the death of all vestiges of ego or selfishness with great compassion. So that's Brahma Sahampati. And finally, the wandering holy man, the symbol of the pursuit of reality, mirrors Muchalinda, the serpent king and young hero, representing the reality at its height. You could say the wandering holy man is also an image for the rest of the Buddha's life. It's the archetype of spiritual life. So we've been through a spiral of interweaving images, each with many meanings, and each sparking off more and more imaginative reflection. And this is, as I said, is the story of Siddhartha, and this is our story. This is your story, because Siddhartha represents the individual human being. In medieval England, there was a play called Everyman, and Everyman, the character Everyman, represented humanity, as it were. Siddhartha is a kind of Everyman. He represents humanity. He symbolizes the life of any human being. We could say, to paraphrase the words of our short puja, Siddhartha was born as we are born. What Siddhartha attained, we too can attain. What Siddhartha overcame, we too can overcome. And we could even say we reverence Siddhartha and aspire to follow him. So this world of imagination and symbols, this world of depths and heights, intuited, imagined, and experienced, this is the context in which we grow old, gain wisdom, suffer, and experience pleasure. This is the rich tapestry of human existence. And this is the context of constant change, constant letting go, constant growth and decay. This is the context in which we live and in which we die. And this vast context of flowing, constant change gives us a perspective that can comfort our suffering or loss. And it can be a call to freedom for our inspiration, for our exuberance. But we have to engage with it. We have to engage with it imaginatively and wholeheartedly. And then death will be less important and life will be more full and meaningful. Anyway, I want to bring this talk to an end by giving the last word to a Christian monk and mystic. Yeah? And this is a Christian monk and mystic who was moved, inspired and awakened by Buddhist images. Thomas Merton, many of you have heard of him, an American Trappist or Carthusian monk. He travelled widely in Asia and had many contacts with Buddhism. And at a place called Polonnaruwa, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, in Sri Lanka, there are some huge Buddhist rupas, Buddhist images, carved from rock. So there's a seated Buddha like this one, except much bigger, and there's a reclining Parinirvana Buddha like the one on the shrine. Again, a huge carved image. There's also a carved image of Ananda standing at the head of the Parinirvana Buddha. Actually, I've got some printouts from the internet of those if you're interested in seeing them. Anyway, Thomas Merton went to this place in 1968 and these Buddha images had a profound effect on him. And he described it in his journal. And just as a kind of poignant little thing, 4 days later he died. He died in an accident in Thailand. So I'll just finish by reading what Thomas Merton said. I'm doing this because, again, one of the points I'm making is about the importance of images and our interaction with images and the power of images and the power of imagination. If we really want to attain spiritual insight, you have to engage with the world imaginatively. It's the imagination is where insight resides. It's the intuition of imagination. That's where insight resides. It's not something literal. It's not something intellectual. Polonnaruwa, with its vast area under trees, fences, few people, no beggars, a dirt road, lost. Then we find Galvihara and the other monastic complex stupas, cells, distant mountains like Yucatan. The path dips down to Galvihara, a wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees, a low outcrop of rock with a cave cut into it, and beside the cave, a big seated Buddha on the left, a reclining Buddha on the right, and Ananda, I guess, standing by the head of the reclining Buddha. In the cave, another seated Buddha. I am able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. The silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing. The peace, not of emotional resignation, but of shunyata, which has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock shape and landscape, figure, rock and tree, and the sweep of bare rock sloping away on the other side of the hollow, where you can go back and see different aspects of the figures. Looking at these figures, I was suddenly, almost forcibly, jerked clean out of the habitual, half-tired vision of things, and an inner clearness, clarity, as if exploding from the rocks themselves, became evident and obvious. The sheer evidence of the reclining figure, the smile, the sad smile of Ananda standing with arms folded. The thing about all this is that there is no puzzle, no problem, no mystery. All problems are resolved, and everything is clear, simply because what matters is clear. The rock, all matter, all life is charged with Dharmakaya. Everything is emptiness, and everything is compassion. I don't know when in my life I have ever had such a sense of beauty and spiritual vitality running together in one aesthetic illumination. I mean, I know and have seen what I was obscurely looking for. I don't know what else remains, but I have now seen and have pierced through the surface and have got beyond the shadow and the disguise. It is clear, pure, complete. It says everything. It needs nothing. Because it needs nothing, it can afford to be silent, unnoticed, undiscovered. It does not need to be discovered. It is we who need to discover it. Thank you.